The Insurance and Banking Subcommittee will come to order. Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chairman DeSigley.
Here.
Vice Chair Hague.
Here.
Ranking Democratic Member Wilhite.
Here.
Representatives Barnaby.
Here.
Beltran.
Here.
Brown.
Here.
Driscoll.
Here.
Fabrico.
Fabricio, present.
Fetterhoff, excused. Hardy.
Here.
Coster.
Here.
Rayner.
Here.
Robinson, excused. Carlos Smith.
Here.
David Smith.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Toledo.
Here.
Zika.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let the record reflect that a quorum is present. Before we begin, a few reminders, members. I will ask everyone to please remember to silence your electronic devices. Also, as a reminder for our members and presenters, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you're speaking and off when you are finished. And also, members, I want to remind you that these mics are pretty hot, so when you do speak into them, just please be aware of that. I want to welcome everybody to the first interim meeting of the Insurance and Banking Subcommittee for the 2021 legislative session. I am honored to serve as your chair, and I thank Speaker Sprouse for this opportunity. I look forward to working with each and every one of you on this very important committee. We're gonna have important policy work to do here. I want you to know that I have an open door policy. If there's anything that you ever need from me, I found that I'm pretty easy to find, and I encourage you to reach out at any time. I'm here to help and be there for you any way that I can. I want to, at this point, typically what we'll do, we have a really in-depth presentation today, and normally I'd love to go around the committee and give the members an opportunity to introduce themselves, but we have an hour in this committee. I want to make sure that you all have time to ask Mr. Gilway some questions because his presentation is really important. So what we're going to do, the next committee meeting, hopefully we have a little bit more time. I'm going to give you an opportunity to, you know, introduce yourselves, let us know where you're from, etc. But with that, I do want to recognize our vice chairman, Representative Brett Hague. I will give the vice chairman a couple of moments to introduce himself. Representative.
Thank you, Chair DeSigley. As he said, I'm Brett Hague. I represent District 33 in Sumter County, a portion of Lake County, and a portion of Marion County. And I'm excited to serve with you guys. So I look forward to getting a lot of good stuff done. So thank you.
Thank you. Also, at this time, I'd like to recognize the Democratic ranking member, Representative Matt Wilhite. Representative, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on behalf of my caucus, we appreciate the opportunity to serve with you and this very important committee and the issues that are so important to it. And know that we'll work with you and hopefully benefit all the citizens and residents of Palm Beach County. That's where I'm from, the state of Florida. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just Palm Beach County, yeah.
Thank you, Representative. And again, I also look forward to working with you as well. With that, I want to take a brief moment here to introduce our policy chief, Ned Luzinski. Ned currently serves as the Deputy Staff Director for the Commerce Committee and Policy Chief for the Insurance and Banking Subcommittee of the Florida House of Representatives. He has over 30 years of experience in the private and public sectors. Ned has worked in Florida state government for the past 16 years with experience in the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. He previously has served as the acting staff director for the Judiciary Committee, as the policy chief for the Business and Professions Subcommittee, and as an attorney for the Florida Senate Committee on Judiciary. He also has held senior positions with the Department of Financial Services and the Department of Business and Professional Regulation. Prior to his work in Florida state government, Ned held consulting and financial management positions in the private sector. Ned earned a JD from Florida State University, an MBA in finance and corporate accounting from the University of Rochester, and a BS in hotel administration from Cornell University. I am very honored to have the opportunity to work with you, Ned, and I encourage the members, if you have any questions, the staff is here to serve you. They're incredibly knowledgeable about this this policy area. Some of this can be very complicated and complex, so I encourage you to take the time to get to know Ned and his staff, because again, they're here to help. So members, we are ready to hear from today's presenter, Barry Gilway, who is the President, CEO, and Executive Director of Citizens Property Insurance Corporation. Citizens is a not-for-profit tax-exempt corporation created by the Florida Legislature in 2002 to provide property insurance to eligible Florida property owners unable to find insurance coverage or unable to find affordable coverage in the private market. We have asked Mr. Gilway to talk about how the Citizens interacts with and impacts Florida's private property insurance marketplace. He will not be discussing the cost drivers affecting the rates today. However, he will be one of the presenters discussing property insurance cost drivers in Florida during the Commerce Committee meeting that will be held tomorrow at 9 a.m. in Webster Hall. Mr. Gilway, you are recognized to begin your presentation. I want to welcome you to the Insurance and Banking Committee, Subcommittee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, and I sincerely appreciate having the opportunity to present in front of you. You might not find this the most exciting presentation that you have listened to. It is relatively long and detailed, and those that are not are less familiar with Citizens, I think will probably be more tuned into what I'm about to talk about today. As the chairman indicated, we're really not going into in significant depth into the problems that we're facing and the solutions. We're really trying to give you a picture of Citizens, the role it plays in the overall marketplace, where we sit, and some of the implications that that relate to Citizens. As the chairman indicated, we were formed basically to provide coverage for those consumers who could not get coverage in the private market, or those consumers that could find coverage but at a price more than 15% over the Citizens rate. We really were created in 2002 and really brought together two prior entities that formed Citizens. The first one was the Florida Wind Underwriting Association, which had been around since 72, and the second is the Florida Residential and Property Casualty Joint Underwriting Association, which was really formed following all of the issues that followed Hurricane Andrew. We have extensive governance. We report to a 9-member board. Three of those members are appointed by the governor, two by the Senate president, two by the Speaker of the House, two by the chief financial officer, and the chief financial officer also is governor who appoints the chair of the of Citizens. We do have an extensive plan of operation, and there is a Citizens statute, and we are subject, the same way all admitted carriers are in Florida, we are subject to regulation by the Office of Insurance Regulation. So ultimately, the OIR does really approve any rate action, policy action, coverage action that we take. The board reviews it. If the board recommends it, it is then referred to the Office of Insurance Regulation. We also are subject to a significant number of reviews. We like to say we're probably one of the most audited companies in on the face of the earth. We are subject to an OIR, market conduct audit, and audit a general audit, and then we have extensive outside audits, very similar to what other admitted companies in the state are subjected to. When it was created from these different entities, so we really formed three different organizations. So each of these components of Citizens, and this, it gets complicated because we're really running three different companies. And they operate in terms of the area that they operate in are very, very different. So first, we really have the personal lines account, and the personal lines account really is more center state, and that's multi-peril property liability policies that operate center state. The coastal account is very specific. They're statutorily defined areas along the coast, again, it's wind only and multi-peril policies, and a significant commercial, residential, and commercial non-residential book of business. And then we have the commercial lines account, which frankly used to be very, very significant, but over the last several years that you'll see in later slides, it has dropped down to a very, very low level. And the commercial lines account basically includes multi-peril policies, condominium associations, apartment buildings, et cetera. But there's been a growing market for the commercial business, dropping that business down to a fairly, I think we're down to some 836 policies. So under Florida law, as I mentioned, you can get into Citizens, A, if coverage is not available from an authorized insurance company, admitted insurance company, and then secondly, if the premiums are higher than that 15%. And the issue with that standard is it's very, very hard to monitor, right? So who knows whether your rates are higher or lower, and who knows whether you're eligible or not? So in 2013, the legislature created a automated shopping mechanism that's called the clearinghouse. And the clearinghouse is there to work with insurers who are interested in assuming, taking out Citizens' business or competing for business before it enters Citizens. And it has worked very, very effectively, you know, at this point. The second way that policies are withdrawn from Citizens into the private market is called the depopulation program. And under the depopulation program, it's really a mechanism basically where a private carrier can come in and they can identify policies that they would like to take out of Citizens, and then consumers have the opportunity to take offers from a number of different private carriers if there's interest on the part of private carriers. We have typical financial financing available to us that any company has. That's the premiums, your investment income, which, by the way, you'll see in our financials is a significant part of Citizens, really offsetting some operating losses that might be occurring. Then you have investment income, obviously. You have operating surplus from prior years. And Citizens has been very fortunate in that up until 2017, of course, we went for 9 years without a Cat 3 storm hitting the shores. And at that point in time, we were a $3.2 billion organization representing 23% of the entire market. So obviously, without those storms, there was a significant opportunity for surplus buildup over that period. And it is very definitely benefiting Citizens today and impacting the position of Citizens in the overall marketplace today. We also obviously get refunds from the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund. And for those who are not familiar with FHCF, or the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund, is really a state-owned reinsurance entity that every company in the state has to participate in. So every admitted company must participate in FHCF at different levels of participation, 45%, 75%, 90%. And then, of course, particularly starting in 2012, we really got aggressive in really trying to transfer the liabilities associated with Citizens offshore. So we placed our first major insurance-linked security, which is a single-purpose entity formed primarily in Bermuda to basically get outside investment dollars to take the risk associated with Citizens. And then, of course, the traditional reinsurance that's utilized by virtually every domestic carrier in the state. But we use a significant amount of insurance-linked security, or another term for it is cat bond, and obviously traditional reinsurance. But the difference between Citizens and the traditional market is in the right-hand column, and that's really we have some unique financial resources. And these are primarily the ability to assess. The next slide actually will show this in a little more detail. There's three levels of assessment that I'll go into. And then we also have pre-event liquidity. So these are also bonds, but they're basically bonds that you buy in advance of an event, which can be costly, but you buy the bond in advance of the event so that there's coverage basically available, funds available, between the time the event occurs and then your need to assess either the private market or customers. So that, and we are really, given our current financial position, slowly but surely, as the cap bonds mature, we're dropping all of the pre-event liquidity bonds, which reduces our overall expenses. So these are really the three levels of assessments that we're able to charge. The first one really goes to, and the assessments are made, by the way, if any one of the three accounts runs out of capital, if they don't have sufficient capital to meet the needs, then the difference between ourselves and the private market is we then can say we're going to assess policyholders under the first level of assessment, Citizens Policyholder Surcharge, and that assessment is up to 15% for each account on the policy premium for that year. If that's still not enough, then we go into the regular assessment, and the regular assessment expands beyond Citizens, and it really applied to all non-Citizens coastal account customers. So not Citizens as customers, but all coastal account policies for all companies. And then if that's not enough to fulfill the deficit, then there's a third layer called an emergency assessment. And that emergency assessment, and in all likelihood, up until 2015, you were all paying. You didn't know it, but you were all paying on your bill. There'd be a slight assessment charge on your bill. So up until 2015, we were still paying off an emergency assessment that goes back to 2005. And then in 2005, we basically paid off the entire, we accelerated the assessment, we paid it off because of our financial condition. And people, they ask, well, geez, do we ever assess? And this is simply a chart that shows, yes, we do. The last major assessment was really in 2005. And at that point, we had to do a regular assessment for $163 million and an emergency assessment for $1.38 billion. And that, of course, is paid off, you know, over time as we can recoup the dollars. Today, there's no assessment charge. So we were able to, you'll see this in subsequent slides, we were able basically to pay off the assessments and then accelerate the payment of assessments because of our overall financial position. And we ended up completing that in 2005. So the financial position of Citizens today is incredibly strong. Today we have about $6.4 billion in surplus. Now, to put that in perspective, if you added up the surplus for all the Florida domestic companies, then you would come up to right around $5.9 billion. So that would be the surplus for the entire Florida domestic market that's operating. And we have $6.4 billion in surplus. The next component there, and you'll, in later slides I'll get into better definition, is called, what is our 100-year PML? Well, PML relates to probable maximum loss. And basically what this is saying is, given the book of business at the time, if a 1 in 100 storm hits Florida, what would be the expected loss based upon our overall exposure in place at the time that that event hit? And that, and all companies calculated on the same basis, and it's called a 100-year PML. And the standard, for example, for private companies is that, typically they're required to reinsure to 130-140% of their 100-year PML. Because that's one storm. And if there are subsequent storms, then obviously you need coverage, reinstatement coverage, you know, to cover secondary storms. In total, we have a claims paying capacity of 10.3 million. And this, of course, includes some of the bonds that we were referring to earlier, the The liquidity bonds that we had earlier, they're dropping off, you know, over time. So total cash and invested assets, about $8.8 billion. The lower chart here is really showing what is occurring at Citizens. So what you'll see in later slides is that because of the extensive investment income, although there's a net underwriting loss at Citizens, we're still in an operating profit position. And that's because the investment income on the significant surplus is sufficient enough to overcome the underwriting losses. So even though the underwriting performance of the company might not be what we want, the significant investment income that we're getting in each of these three accounts, that's allocated to each of the three accounts, offsets that underwriting loss. And there'll be a a slide a little later on that showed a little more detail. The discouraging thing, of course, and that's why we have it in red in the bottom, is that the personal lines account, which is where on future slides you'll see much more detail, the personal lines account is the account that is growing and growing rapidly, not the coastal account, where you would think we have a significant problem with the wind and the hurricane losses. It's really the PLA account. This shows the losses in the PLA account. Obviously, the 17 losses in the PLA account, significant ones, are Irma-related, you know, losses. This slide is, we call this, this is everything we're trying to avoid within Citizens. So if you go back to 2011, what this is showing you is that if we were to have had that 1 in 100 storm in 2011, then we would have had to assess, through the three mechanisms that I reviewed with you, $11.6 billion. Now, at the time, we had grown to $512 billion, a half a trillion dollars in exposure. And as along the top here, it's the PML here is referred to as storm risk. So in this case, for example, in 2011, we had grown to the point where we had about $24 billion worth of PML, or storm risk. And even though you had reinsurance in place, et cetera, you still would have assessed $11.6 billion. So the whole key with Citizens as a state entity, that's a state liability, ultimately, directly affects the state bond rating. So what we don't want to do is ever get back to the point where we're in a position, basically, to assess policyholders. We did several things in 12, 13, 14. We bought more and more reinsurance to transfer the risk offshore. That reduced the assessment. And then, of course, what we'll be talking about is the depopulation program and the impact that reducing the overall size of Citizens has on the overall liability, you know, of the state. So this is a history of policies. And to some extent, you know, Citizens is kind of like a roller coaster ride. We were referred to recently in an article as a relief valve. And it's not a positive thing to review, but the bottom line is we have operated historically as a relief valve. When there's been problems in the overall marketplace, and Citizens, obviously, there's been a movement into Citizens. What you see here on the top in the light green numbers, what you're seeing there, for example, if you go to 2007, 6 and 7, what you'll see is that was the liquidation of Poe. And for those that were around at the time, Poe was significant. That was 360,000 policyholders that moved from Poe in the Poe insolvency to Citizens literally overnight. So there's a massive movement overnight. So you'll see during that time, Citizens policies, most definitely in the PLA, increased dramatically. And then they dropped off. Well, why did it drop off? It dropped off because even though that company went insolvent, there's a lot of good policies within that the number of policies that were transferred over. And then, of course, depopulation responded. The depopulation program responded, and policies were taken out. You see the same phenomena again, you know, in 2000 and if I can read that, in 2011, simply because you had three companies that went insolvent. And as a result of that, policies moved into Citizens. Then we enter what we'll be talking about going forward. Then we entered into a very, very heavy depopulation period. And what you'll see, basically, is that, and I should have gone back to that. What you'll see, basically, in future slides is that Citizens' policy count is directly related to the overall profitability of the market. And if you think about it, it does make sense, right? If the market is profitable, then there's plenty of capital, and companies start competing for business. And the depopulation plan, if you're a businessman, the depopulation program, it literally gives you, in Heritage's case, 250,000 policies with no acquisition costs whatsoever. And in addition to that, we service that business for free from the assumption date, the date that the contract is signed, to the end of the individual policy period. So it's a great deal for companies who want to grow. And when the marketplace is healthy and there's plenty of capital, then depopulation takes place. Currently, however, what we're seeing is, and you'll see it on a subsequent slide, and as a result of the issues that are occurring in the overall market, capacity is restricted. So what does that do? And that's basically saying we got down ultimately at a low point. We started at 1.5 million policies in 2011, and that represented 23% of the entire market. So one out of every four homes in Florida was insured by Citizens, a point we never, ever want to reach again. We got all the way down to 420,000 policies. And by the way, at 420, based on the size of a market, that's a pretty good number for a residual market. It matches pretty much up with Massachusetts, North Carolina, Texas, the big residual market states. So we got down to that 420 level. Market started restricting. Capacity started restricting in the marketplace. We start to grow. So today, the turn came with the insolvency of a Florida specialty company. There was about 100,000 policies. We picked up about 20,000 of those. So that started the initial growth from 420. From that point on, we have been growing at the rate of 3,000 net new policies per week. So every week, we are growing by 3,000 customers on a net basis. And that's coming about for two reasons. One, obviously, new business growth has gone from 7,000 a month to 17,000 a month. And the other aspect is, typically, you've got a retention ratio of customers in the low 80s. Now you've got a retention ratio in the 90s. Nobody's leaving because there's really no place for those customers to go. This is just basically showing some similar information. It really shows also the source of the new business. And what this is showing basically, I think the biggest issue here is that it is showing that the type of business that we're getting is primarily multi-peril homeowners business. The bottom chart basically shows that South Florida is the biggest source of that business. If you take a look at South Florida, Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County combined, mostly Dade and Broward, then basically what you're finding, is that about 70% of the new business coming into Citizens is coming in from those southeast counties. This basically is showing. Excuse me a minute. I'm fogging up. This basically is showing the kind of business that we write. So when you take a look at the homeowners' new business that are coming in, you'll see basically we're not a market for statutorily we're restricted now with the exception of Dade and Monroe, we're restricted to homes a maximum of coverage A of 700,000. So we don't write large homes. And typically, the market for larger homes with larger coverage A's has been far more robust. And so we play basically in that 100,000 coverage A home all the way up to 300,000 coverage A. You can see the vast majority of our business, you know, is in that category. We write, you know, the small to medium-sized home, and we don't write the larger home. The larger homes are either written by the admitted market, or many of them, until recently, were written by the surplus lines marketplace. The other aspect of our business that makes us a residual market, if you will, is basically the age of the home that we write. Obviously, for the most part, people don't come to us with new homes. There's lots of markets out there for new homes. So we tend to write a significant number of older homes. And this chart just basically shows that, you know, we really, our biggest volume is all the way from, you know, 20 years old all the way up to, you know, 70, 80, 90, 100 year old homes. This is just one example of new business trend. Now, if I'd have shown this chart 3 months ago, it would have shown basically that I mentioned that the surplus lines market, the non-admitted market in Florida, they had grown significantly over the course of the last several years. So now that the market has shifted, if this slide would have been shown just 3-4 months ago, then the vast majority of new business coming in was really the 4 or 5 top surplus lines carriers. They tend to come in, take advantage of the overall market when they can at high rates. When they can't get those rates anymore, they move the business. They move out of the business. You still have carriers, the Lloyd's carriers here, Scottsdale, and some other companies that are non-admitted that are a source of business today. But now it really is coming from a really good cross-section of the 63 S&P companies that are doing business in Florida. And as I mentioned to the chairman, we won't get into a lot of the problems, if you will, in the market today. But I think this is a key slide that's critical to even understand what's happening in the marketplace. This basically are the results of the Florida domestic marketplace over the course of the last, since 2013. So in 2013 through 2015, Florida was an incredibly profitable market. And as you'll see in subsequent slides, lots of depopulation occurred, you know, during those years. It shifted in 2016 all the way to the point where we had the industry had its worst year through three quarters of this year with a $727 million net income loss and a $1.26 billion underwriting loss. One of the issues that we'll be talking about, you know, during the legislative session will be citizens' rates. And we were designed to be a residual market carrier. And on the next slide, you'll see that in 2007, we were required to be the most uncompetitive company in the state. And frankly, most residual market companies are set up to be, you know, non-competitive and not compete with the private marketplace. Citizens, this just gives you an example. We do a homeowner survey every year, and this last year was just completed in November. 91% of citizens' homeowners' policies are charged less than the private marketplace. Last year, that same survey showed about 85%. Now, why is that? Well, in 07, we were required to be non-competitive. However, in the following year, you know, policy rates were frozen, you know, for 2 years. And then the glide path, you know, was implemented. And the glide path basically says that no individual policyholder can receive an increase of more than 10% in any year. So there's a limitation. And so you would say, well, 10% is not bad if you can get that year over year. But really, the rating mechanisms don't work that way, right? Because there are areas in the state that are profitable. So you don't, you know, you so when you're looking at this, you're really looking at, well, areas that are profitable, offsetting some of the areas that are unprofitable. So you end up with a rate increase, let's say, in the mid 4 or 5 range, as opposed to the full 10%. And what you'll hear tomorrow, I'm sure, is that many carriers, and the commissioner mentioned it yesterday in the Senate, that lots of rate increases occurring across the marketplace in excess of 10%. Over 50% of the increases were over 10%. So obviously we're getting more and more and more competitive because we can't keep up with that, with those numbers. The biggest difference here is that because of our financial position, the major difference is that reinsurance is a huge issue in Florida, huge issue. So many companies today really are ceding 50, 60% of their premium to reinsurers. So really it's the reinsurers that are really providing the rates. Reinsurance rates are skyrocketing because of the loss development in Irma. And as a result, what we have here is we have a situation where citizens in a position, we don't need to buy the same level of reinsurance that that a private carrier does. So you have an automatic difference. And the difference basically amounts to the difference between we spend 5.66 cents on the dollar for reinsurance, the industry spends about 21 cents, you know, so for their overall book of business, excluding FHCF. So we're in a very enviable position, but it puts us in a position where we're constantly more competitive, you know, than the marketplace. So one of the areas, Mr. Chairman, that you asked me to address was the issue that's getting a lot of conversation today, and that's a proposal by Senator Brandis that he brought forth to citizens regarding what I'll call either bifurcated rate or uncapped rates for new business. So the legislation is not clear relative to whether that glide path should apply to new business, because the legislation says that policyholders are subject to an increase no more than 10%. So the legislation is not clear, and we got an outside opinion that basically says, well, it would be acceptable for OIR and for citizens to really charge two rates. If we want to stop the flow of new business coming in at rates that are, from an industry standpoint, actuarially not sound, then really you could charge the same rates for current customers that we do today, and they'd be subject to the glide path, so they wouldn't be disadvantaged. But on the new rates, for anyone coming in, they would have to pay an actuarially sound rate, not subject to the glide path. So the board, actually the legislature considered this in 2012 and rejected the opportunity to do that. This year, Senator Brandis asked us to update the legal opinion to see if that had changed. It had not. So it is an area of discussion, and it's really in Office of Insurance Regulations' hands to determine whether that is appropriate or not appropriate to move forward with as a rating mechanism. It sounds like a panacea, and I'm not taking a position on it, but it's important as to know why there's a lot of discussion on this one issue, because it's not as simple as saying, well, everybody gets a higher rate if they're coming in. Because what this would mean basically is that 45% of the current policies would see a decrease of about 3%, and the 54% would see an increase of around 21%. And that's basically of the volume of business that's coming, you know, through the door. So, and that's an average. So one of the issues, of course, is that if it's an average, some people could get five, some people could get 200. So there are a lot of issues to deal with when assessing that opportunity that is being presented. Ultimately, this is in the hands of Office of Insurance Regulation. The board referred it at our last board meeting to OIR to assess the appropriate position to take on the dual rate structure. So I wanted to get into some detail, and I want to be conscious of time here too, Mr. Chairman. So I'll go through some of these very, very quickly. The clearinghouse I mentioned before, that's a mechanism to take a look at policies as they come in. This simply shows the companies that are participating today in that. This basically shows how you enter through the clearinghouse. You buy a new house, you go to your agent. If the agent can place it, great. If they can't place it, or if they can't place it at a reasonable price within 15%, it's sent through the clearinghouse, and those participating carriers have an opportunity to quote on that business. So new business, the bottom line here is that virtually no carriers today are quoting. So I can show you a lot of statistics, but there's a very, very simple bottom line. Nobody wants our business today. So nobody's quoting on that business. It was pretty extensive during the year, during 13, 14, 15, but today, really, the clearinghouse new business participation has been very, very slim. This also applies, clearinghouse also applies to all renewals. So every renewal we have is forced through the clearinghouse every year at renewal. And any agent, again, any of the participating companies have an opportunity to look at every renewal every year and say, do I want that policy? And of course, same issue here. That was pretty extensive. It reduced the number of policies that remain with Citizens historically. Today, there are simply no offers. And the next chart, this is policyholder communication. I won't go into a lot of detail on that, but we do have an extensive policyholder communication program that Christine Ashburn and her communications organization handles to make sure that no matter what is happening through the clearinghouse mechanism, then we're very, very clear with our customer in terms of what is happening. Renewal results, same basic results, very few policies. This is the ultimate slide here. This basically shows the carriers that are participating and the offers that are occurring. And it's really redundant with the prior slides in that it's basically showing that virtually no companies today are really quoting on that business, either new or renewal. And they're not doing it basically because there's really very little capacity in the marketplace to add new policies. This really is a description of the assumption process. We talk about depopulation. So what happens here, and I'll just do it in two sentences, is a company wants some of our policies. They get to look at our whole book of business. If they want policies, they go to the Office of Insurance Regulation. They say, I want 20,000 policies. Office of Insurance Regulation says, well, you have the financial wherewithal to handle 10,000 of those, or 5,000, or 20,000. And gives them the ability to sign an assumption agreement. The assumption agreement goes into place. The company then chooses. So let me give you some examples for December. December, there were two companies that assumed business that put in an assumption agreement. Weston and Florida Penn. So between the two of them, 20,000 policies. By the time they had reviewed the policies, they sent out 10,000 offer letters, and about 2,000 actually left Citizens. So very, very slim. But the offers are made by the companies to the policies they identify, and then really it's up to the consumer as to whether they want to accept the offer or not accept the offer. And policyholder communications a depopulation trend. Obviously, this is what I'm describing. It has dropped significantly. Very little depopulation occurring today. In the past, we had more attractive policies. We had newer homes with no claims, et cetera. Reinsurance was affordable. Financial position of participants was stronger, the company participants, and the policy premiums were closer. But today, the current barriers are, as I've stated, due to depopulation. The majority of policies aren't desirable today to the private marketplace, or the carriers simply don't have the capacity to pick up our business. This simply shows some of the major depopulation companies. I think everyone's familiar with Heritage. They actually picked up some almost 300,000 policies through the depopulation program. And today, Heritage is one of the largest insurance companies in the state. The last slide is really the FSU study. We conducted a study, and that study was done by Florida State University. It was an external study. It was initially requested, the study was requested by Senator Brandis, and we underwent a process to identify the best source to do a complete analysis, and we came up with FSU. They had done analysis for the legislature before, and they did come up with numerous areas where extensive depopulation could benefit from depopulation. Most of these areas, as you'll see, most of the areas really are outside of citizens' control. But here's some examples. We already operate the depopulation through the clearinghouse. We have revised mitigation credits. Some of those haven't been revised for a decade, so they're now more appropriate. It's part of our latest filing. We were increasing the use of inspections on our homes. So some of these, the first category, are well underway. The managed repair program, probably one of the best programs we've launched at Citizens. Very, very successful in reducing litigation. And by the way, very highly approved by the policyholders who use it. The second category here really are legislative actions. Things like requiring ADRs, alternative dispute resolution or mediation, addressing the attorney fee multipliers, considering changes to the one-way attorney 627-428, modifying or eliminating the glide path on rates. There's several things you can do without eliminating it. Applying the provisions of AOB, because AOB has been very, very successful for Citizens and the industry. We'll show some numbers on that in the Commerce tomorrow. Then there's really recommendations that we need to consider, really getting the word out more to investors on Citizens, creating new business models. I won't get into that today because we are running out of time and I want to allow some questions. But there are different ways that we could package policies, for companies to make it more receptive for them. And then considering financial support for mitigation, considering policy form changes. And then there really are items for the general industry, strengthening building codes, creating a database for residential property, creating a much more significant fraud capability across the state for property, revised building criteria in high-risk areas, creating new industry business model. So there are four different categories that FSU delivered to us. We're presenting to the board. We formed, or reformed, if you will, a depopulation committee of the board, and we're going to be looking at all opportunities that would improve our depopulation efforts and try and reduce the size or at least stem the tide of the growth that we're seeing today. So, Mr. Chairman, I tried to give us some time for questions at the end, so more than open for questions, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Gilway, and I appreciate you allowing us to do some questions. So members, we're gonna go into questions. Representative Driscoll, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation today. I had a few questions, but I'll start with this one. It sounds like then maybe you are not optimistic about the effectiveness of depopulation going forward. Am I hearing that theme correctly?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, yes, you're exactly right, Representative Driscoll. The issue for us is that depopulation works extremely well when the industry is doing well. Mm-hmm. So when the industry is doing well, it means basically they have earnings, they have additional capital, and without additional capital, they can't assume more liabilities, you know, from citizens. So I'm not optimistic that without significant legislative change, you know, and that will impact the profitability of the private marketplace, that depopulation will recover.
Recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another question, I saw one of the initiatives that you mentioned was increase the use of inspections. Could you talk about that a bit more? I imagine there's probably an industry standard for the regularity with which inspections are supposed to take place. The citizens behind the curve on that?
To some extent, we are. The industry typically, for example, on a new home, the industry requires what you call a four-point inspection. So it's just a basic inspection that is required. However, some companies are way ahead of that. Some companies do internal inspections. Some companies do inspection water damage inspections, you know, internally. We still require four-point inspections consistent with industry standard, but we're still getting in, you know, policies that with a more extensive inspection program and a more frequent inspection program, I think would identify any issues with that insured that can be corrected prior to entry, you know, into citizens.
Final question?
One more bite at the apple. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the last question is that I have is about assignment of benefits. I know that you mentioned that there will be a presentation in Commerce tomorrow, but for those of us who don't have the benefit of serving on Commerce, you know, assignment of benefits legislation was a significant reform, and I remember citizens being strongly in favor of that. Could you just give us a brief overview of the impact that it's had?
Yeah, I can, yes. So the assignment of benefits legislation has been tremendously successful, not only for citizens, but for the industry. I'll give you a couple of numbers. What we'll be showing tomorrow is that assignment of benefits litigation has dropped 46%, you know, for citizens over the last 12 months, and it's dropped 37% for the industry. So there's been a significant drop in AOB litigation. The offset, unfortunately, is that for the industry in particular, there has been an increase in first party. So AOB is third party, you know, litigation focusing on the contractors. So that has been very successful. However, there's now been a shift so that the focus now is on first party or direct consumer litigation. So attorneys working directly with consumers, and that is increasing to the extent, frankly, where the benefit associated for the industry, the benefit associated with AOB is completely offset by the increase in litigation, in first party litigation.
Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Mr. Galloway, for your presentation. I wonder if you had any thoughts. Obviously, everyone in this room probably remembers 1992 and Hurricane Andrew and how it changed the industry and the standards and the building codes and so many inspections, as you just mentioned. But, you know, it's funny that insurance and banking are on the same topic here, because a lot of people in Florida right now compare their insurance to what's in their bank account because they understand how expensive and sometimes difficult it is to get insurance. Yet we've spent so much into our homes or in hardening and new impact windows and shutters and all these different things, screens, all these different things. Yet it still seems, and I've heard from so many people about how expensive it is for them to get insurance, the coverage, how their insurance companies can drop them. They're left without anything. What did they do? The times that they can't close on a mortgage because we're hurricanes pending, all those different things. Do you have any thoughts on how insurance in the industry has changed so much since these hurricanes and the advent of it? And they're becoming so prevalent about, are people going to be able to buy homes? I mean, we support home ownership. I mean, the average home in Palm Beach County is $350,000. And then you have to have insurance on that. Can people really afford in the future here to buy homes and insure them and be safe and secure in them and know that they'll always have insurance to protect them?
Well,
you're recognized, Chairman.
That's an excellent question. It's really the essence of the need, frankly, for legislative reform. And the reason I say that is if you go back to my prior charts, you would see back in 13, 14, and 15, rates were dropping like a rock across the industry. In 13, 14, and 15, you had companies reducing their rates by 10, 15, 20% in order to compete for business in the marketplace. Well, that stopped, and it stopped dramatically in 2016, and you saw that shift. So as the industry became more unprofitable, as they had negative net income, and as they started to reduce their overall capital, their net income was not only dropping, but it was negative for 3 years, then capacity dried up. So what you're seeing right now is exactly what you're saying. Many companies simply, they don't have the capacity to write new business. They don't have the reinsurance capacity to write new business. So the solution, in my opinion, this is simplifying it because there's many, many ways to get there, but the solution, in my opinion, is really you've got to get the industry to the point where there's a reasonable rate of return in the industry, and once you get the industry to the point where there's a reasonable rate of return, then you're going to have the same thing that occurred in 13, 14, and 15, and you're going to have competition, you know, for homeowners. I will say there are areas of the state now where pricing, I would agree with you, is completely ridiculous. Dade County, you know, for a $250,000 coverage A home, you're paying $5,900, you know, compared to the rest of the state, which is around, you know, $2,300, $2,400. So it's a huge differential in rates. It's driven fundamentally, and I won't get into this too much, but it's driven fundamentally by the litigation rate that's occurring. I mean, overall litigation has gone from 27,000 litigated cases in 2013 to 85,000 litigated cases last year. And the problem basically is the industry is simply not keeping up with it. And I'll try and stay away from those issues. But that's the fundamental problem, is the litigation that's occurring across the state and creating unprofitability for the companies, and the companies can't keep up.
All right, members, we have, unfortunately, looks like we're going to have time for one more question. I know Representative Beltran, your hand was up after Ranking Member Wilhite, so you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, sir, for sharing this information about the insurance industry here in Florida. I had a couple of questions. Maybe we'll follow up another time. But I just want to understand broadly, what are the considerations in terms of shifting risk through a cat bond versus buying reinsurance and why? It sounds like what you told us today is that Citizens favors doing the cat bond or perhaps not shifting all of its risk. And why is that versus a private monoline, for instance? Why would you take a different approach?
Mr. Chairman. You're recognized.
So really, the difference between insurance-linked security or a cat bond and traditional, the decision basically comes down to the rate on line or the pricing of each of these areas. Up until 3 years ago, there was a significant difference between the pricing in the ILS or the cat bond marketplace versus traditional. So obviously, you know, companies that really were large enough to take advantage of that, maybe four or five, six in the state, were really going into the cat bond marketplace, the ILS marketplace. I'm paying significantly less. I mean, you're talking maybe a 5% rate on line versus a 8% rate on line for a specific layer of your reinsurance coverage. So the decision basically is really rate. You know, what are we going to pay the reinsurers for the same coverage? Now, last year, it got more complex because the traditional market says, I'm not going to provide multi-year coverage. And the cat bond always provides multi-year coverage.
Mr. Gilway, I'm sorry to do this. I can't tell you how much I hate to do this, but we're like 30 seconds away, and I've got to adjourn the meeting at 5 o'clock. Members, I encourage you to reach out to Mr. Gilway.
Yes.
There's a lot of information that's important that I want to make sure that you all have. So if there's no further business, that concludes our agenda for today's meeting. I want to thank all of our presenters for being here today, even though there was only one. Representative Hague moves, we rise without objection. The meeting is adjourned.